I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Ellen Wohl. She is a professor of geology at Warner College of Natural Resources at Colorado State University. And she will be giving a lecture tonight at 5:30 titled Beavers, Architects and Engineers, Our Last Best Hope for Healthier Headwater Streams in the Face of Climate Change. It's part of the Amigos Bravos Water Matters Lecture Series, and it's at the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So there are so many ways that human activities have affected streams and rivers and wetlands all over the United States. What are some of the overt and subtle things that we humans do to change our natural waterways?
Well, as you mentioned, there's a wide variety. I think many people are aware of what is done within the channels, things like building dams or diversions, removing wood from the channels or beavers and beaver dams, creating levees. But an important thing to keep in mind is that rivers integrate the entire landscape and the entire watershed that they drain. So things that happened in the upland can also affect rivers quite a bit, whether it's timber harvest or other changes in the vegetation cover or land use. Those affect water and sediment coming into the channel and nutrients. So, as you said, there have been widespread effects throughout not just the U.S., but the world, and there are very few places where rivers are not affected, either directly by altering the channel or indirectly by those changes in the uplands.
One of the things that you just mentioned, I found really interesting when I was reading one of your papers. There used to be a lot more wood in rivers than there is now. Why is that? What is the effect of wood in rivers, and what happens when you take it out?
That's a good question that a lot of people don't think about because we're used to seeing rivers with very little wood. But if you have a river flowing through a forest, the trees die individually or they die in groups when you have things like fires or big winds or insect infestations, and some of those trees fall into the channel. The wood in most rivers is very important both in terms of the physical processes and in terms of the biology. In the physical processes, the wood creates obstacles to the flow. So you get ponded water. You can have water directed out of the channel onto the floodplain. You can have pools scoured underneath the wood that are really good fish habitat. And if the water is being influenced in terms of its rate of movement downstream, then you can increase the chances for storing fine sediment and a lot of organic material that is the base of the aquatic food web in very small rivers. Things like pine cones and leaves, the very fairly fine material that aquatic insects ingest, and then, of course, other things ingest the insects, like fish or birds. So in terms of the physical processes, it's mainly that it makes the channel more complex and allows it to retain water, sediment, and nutrients for longer periods of time. And then biologically, it provides by retaining that organic matter, it provides the source of the food web in many small streams and also provides a lot of habitat for organisms such as insects and fish. So the other part of your question, why aren't we used to seeing this? There are pretty amazing records of the amount of wood taken out of rivers. I've been focusing mainly on North America, but if you go back to the earliest descriptions of people of European descent coming into this continent, our ancestors were pretty busy pulling out wood as soon as they got there, either to increase navigation on the rivers, to decrease the overbank flooding. In some cases, they thought the wood was bad for fish, which is the opposite of what we think now. But we have centuries of pulling wood out of rivers, so most of us are just used to seeing rivers with no wood, even if they flow through forested environments. And consequently, we have this perception of wood often that's very negative. We see it as a hazard or as something that's messy and should be removed. And scientists have a very different view. Those who work in rivers, both ecologists and geologists like myself, have a very positive view of wood. So I think one of the most important things we can do is work to reintroduce wood to rivers and change public attitudes towards wood in rivers.
It seems like that goes along with a whole American obsession across the board with cleanliness and neatness. I mean, the idea that a river should be clean of wood is, as you say, just really wrong. Just as we think we should be clean of bacteria or of insects or things that are really integral either to our ecosystems or to our own bodies' functioning systems.
That's a really good parallel. I like that. Yeah, it's in terms of rivers, there have been some nice papers that have shown that the cumulative effect of human actions is to homogenize and simplify rivers, whether it's building dams that change the distribution of water through the year or introducing exotic fish. We've got certain types of fish all over North America, such as carp. And, yeah, we make things simpler and more uniform, and I guess out of us for aesthetic reasons, but the unfortunate part of that is that often those are interfering with biological or ecosystem functions that we don't understand. And you mentioned bacteria in our own bodies. You know, there have been some interesting studies showing that children that are exposed to certain levels of bacteria, such as you'd get in a farm or a ranch, are actually healthier later in life. They have better immune systems. So I think sometimes our tendency to make things clean and simple backfires on us in ways that we don't think about at the beginning.
What are some of the other activities that we do that decrease biodiversity in and around rivers?
Well, probably the largest single effect would be the manipulation of the water and the channel form itself. So dams and diversions are a huge influence around the world, not just in the U.S. Biologically, probably the single biggest influence is introduced species. I presume it's similar in New Mexico, but certainly in Colorado, our native trout is the cutthroat, and it's endangered. We have lots of brook, brown, and rainbow trout, which are native to other parts of North America, or in the case of the brown trout, to Europe. So I know most biologists consider the problems with introduced species to be one of the primary effects.
And then there's also the effect of nearby agriculture and roads and timber harvesting and things like that, and even construction of ski resorts. They all affect rivers.
Yeah, the specifics in terms of what affects an individual river obviously vary, but yeah, you mentioned ski resorts. If they make snow and they take water from one catchment and freeze it and blast it onto the slopes of snow and that water drains into another catchment, that can be the single biggest effect on the small headwater streams that are receiving that water. We did some work in the White River National Forest in Colorado, which has many of our largest commercial ski resorts, and the peak flow in some of those small channels can increase by 300% because of snowmaking. So for those channels, that's the biggest impact. It varies with the specific catchment, but yes, there are a lot of things that go on in the uplands that definitely influence the rivers.
We're talking to geologist Ellen Wool. Now, there have been both successful and failed attempts in river restoration. What are some of the things we learn from the failed attempts?
Well, it actually goes back to the conversation we had a moment ago about appearance and neatness. A lot of the smaller scale river restoration projects will focus on the form of the river, just the way it looks, rather than thinking about the processes that maintain that form and the functions of the river. And a classic example for me is when people take things like backhoes and they create this beautifully sinuous channel that looks like a meandering river, and then they stabilize the banks so the river can't move. Meandering rivers are inherently mobile. They erode on the outside of each bend and deposit on the inside. So with time, the meanders shift back and forth across the floodplain. And that's very important in creating habitat diversity and in maintaining the movement of water and sediment through the channel. So when you create a meandering channel and then fix the banks in place, it's not going to be stable. And a lot of those systems, those restoration projects, are destroyed in even fairly moderate-sized floods within a few years. So I think the single most important lesson we've learned is to think about function and process rather than just form and appearance of the river.
It's interesting because, I mean, as I understand it, the creation of these meandering rivers when they're trying to do river restoration is in response to that kind of Army Corps of Engineers straight line channelized rivers, which of course make the water flow too quickly and is also bad for fish. But if you don't do the meandering right, you also get it wrong.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the idea of restoring a meandering river is in many cases quite appropriate. It's just that you're creating this static meandering river that's not going to last very long. There are some famous examples in the scientific literature where people, agencies or municipalities, spent a lot of money to put this beautiful meandering channel in and fix it in place, and then within 3 or 4 years, a moderate-sized flood completely destroyed that newly created channel. So there's a couple things there. One is not fixing the channel in place. The other is being aware of changes in the setting where you're trying to restore the channel. So, for example, maybe there's a braided river that is in place right now, and people want to restore it to a meandering channel. That can work if the things that maintain a meandering channel are also in place. But if there's a braided channel because there's a lot more sediment coming into that site than there was, say, historically, even if you try to create a meandering channel, it's going to go back to a braided channel. So being aware of the, outside influences beyond the immediate river reach that you're restoring is also very important, because you ultimately want to create a self-maintaining channel. And if you try to impose something that's out of balance with the existing water and sediment coming into that stream reach, it's not going to work in the long run.
One of the things that I gather is tricky about river restoration is to figure out what the natural state of the river or stream ever was in the first place, because there's been so much human effect on it. How do you figure out what the state should be?
That's a very good question. You can use sometimes historical records, just going back a few decades, like aerial photos. It depends, of course, when the land use or resource use started that altered the river. In some cases, you can use prehistoric information, such as sediments deposited in the floodplain or in the valley bottom, that geologists can interpret to see what type of river was there in the past. I think the one thing I'd stress, though, is even if you know what type of river was there, say, in prehistory or historically, it may not be appropriate to try to restore that, again, if other things like the amount of water and sediment coming into the channel have changed. So it's very useful to know what was there in the past, but you also have to think about whether that type of river can be self-sustaining under current conditions. And to get at that question, there is a lot of scientific research that's been done that shows the conditions under which different channel types, like meandering versus braided, are stable in terms of things like the downstream gradient or steepness of the valley bottom, or the amount of water and sediment coming in, or the stability of the stream banks. So you can also use that information to say, all right, maybe there was a meandering river here in the past. Would a meandering river be self-sustaining if I tried to restore that today? Or, no, it looks like, based on the water and sediment, it's going to revert to a braided river pretty quickly.
Let's talk about beavers, which are the subject of your talk tonight. Where in North America do beavers live, or have they lived in the past?
In the past, they lived everywhere there was forest. So they were from the northern part of Alaska down to northern Mexico, and from the west coast of North America over to the east coast. And that was Castor canadensis, the species in North America. Castor fiber was in Eurasia from China up into Siberia over to, of course, Scandinavia and down to northern Spain. So they were very widespread and a lot more abundant than we're used to seeing them today. Beaver still live throughout North America. They're just much, much smaller population numbers pretty much everywhere. There are parts of Alaska and northern Canada where they may be close to historic population levels, but everywhere else they're much fewer in number.
It's so interesting when, especially laymen like me, who are not involved in science and the close study of species, but you look at some species like beavers and coyotes who are so adaptive and they can live anywhere. And then there's other species that are really specific to an area and a certain kind of predator or prey or plant that they need to survive. And without that, the whole species can go extinct very easily. What is the key to beavers' success and adaptability?
That's probably a better question for a biologist, but I'll give you my perspective as a geologist. They are able to eat a variety of woody riparian species. There's certain things they like better, like birch and cottonwood and aspen, but they can eat the types of plants that grow on rivers throughout forested regions. And they, even on the big rivers that they can't dam, they're called bank beavers. I think that's a very informal term. They just dig burrows into the banks, so they don't dam the river, but they can still live in that environment. And working here in Colorado, I found beaver dams in the tiniest headwaters where I never expected to see them, really steep, narrow canyons. Some of them are right above bedrock waterfalls. They're the daredevil beavers. So they're very adaptable in terms of where they can build dams. I've also seen dams that have everything from moose antlers to cobbles and boulders incorporated in them. So they use a lot of things besides just wood to build these dams. And they're one of the species that ecologists refer to as ecosystem engineers, because they can manipulate the environment through building their dams and create a lot of habitat for other species. And in the case of beavers, one of the things that impresses me about them is that they essentially ensure their own food supply, particularly in our part of the West, the semi-arid or arid West. When a beaver builds a dam, it's similar to the effect I was describing for wood earlier. It creates a backwater area, so you get sediment deposited, and it also forces the water to go out of the channel during high flows, like the snowmelt flow. So you have this very wet valley bottom. That some of that water infiltrates and creates a high water table, and that high water table favors species like willows and river birch that the beaver like to eat, and it keeps the upland species, such as spruce and fir and pines, from encroaching on the valley bottom. So the beavers kind of keep their own refrigerator or larder, if you like, by maintaining this wet valley bottom that favors the type of food they like to eat. And that may be one of the things that's allowed them to spread, or allowed them to spread historically, to places you wouldn't think of, like some of the drier parts of Arizona and New Mexico. As long as there was a perennial stream, there were beaver there historically.
And so those dams really are, that they create are what helped them to survive.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
So what good do their dams also do for the surrounding ecosystems?
Well, if you have those wet valley bottoms, there's a couple things that are involved. One is that it's creating a different environment than the uplands. So it's increasing habitat diversity, and you get a different variety of plants and animals and insects and fish and pretty much everything scientists have looked at that are able to live in those wet valley bottoms. The beaver also, of course, are constantly moving across the valley bottom. They'll build a dam. The pond will gradually fill with sediment. They'll build a new dam and move somewhere else. So they're creating diverse habitats within that wet valley bottom. And in looking at the ecological literature, one of the things that's impressed me is pretty much every species that scientists have looked at, from bacteria to insects, fish, birds, reptiles, amphibians, mammals, a wide variety of plants, they find a much greater diversity of species in these wet valley bottoms that are sometimes called beaver meadows than in the adjacent uplands. So if you imagine a landscape on a map, it's like the beaver meadows are hotspots of biodiversity. They also, by creating that ponding effect, store a lot of organic matter that has nutrients in it, so carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus. So these are also these hotspots of biogeochemistry, where lots of nutrients are stored that helps to support a high abundance as well as a high diversity of other organisms. So that gets back to the idea of ecosystem engineers. The beavers create these hotspots in the landscape through their dam building activities.
And that also affects the water downstream.
Absolutely. If you have a broad, wet valley bottom with a bunch of dams in it, the water's going to move through much more slowly. That's one of the reasons the sediment and the organic matter can settle out. So you attenuate or slow down the passage of flood waves. And if the flood wave, like the snowmelt peak flow every year, is slowed down, it's less erosive in downstream channels. By storing carbon and nitrogen and other nutrients and organic matter in the beaver meadows, you're also reducing the fluxes of those downstream. And that's a big issue in the western U.S. because most of us live at the base of the mountains, and we rely for our surface water supply on flow coming out of those mountains, the snowmelt peak flows. And if you have a lot of organic matter in water, it doesn't hurt you if you drink it, but it makes the water taste and smell a little funny and can give it kind of a brown tinge sometimes. So water managers like to remove things like dissolved and particulate organic carbon from drinking water. And if they don't remove it effectively, they have to add more chlorine just to cover up the taste and the smell. And chlorine can combine with organic matter, with carbon, to form a byproduct called trihalomethanes that are carcinogens. So you really want to limit the amount of carbon in the water and limit the amount of treatment that you have to do with chlorine. And, of course, we have natural functions that can do that for us and store some of that material up in the headwaters, and beaver dams are one of those.
We're talking to geologist Ellen Wohl, who will be here in Santa Fe tonight talking about beavers, architects and engineers, what happens to rivers and to ecosystems when beavers are removed?
There's a couple things that happen in the specific site where the beavers formerly occupied, that I've been referring to as a beaver meadow. As the dams fall into disrepair, the flow is less likely to go overbank. It's contained within the main channel, so you lose some of that seasonal flooding of the valley bottom. The wetlands start to dry up. You have less organic matter stored there. Typically, the water table in that section of the valley bottom drops. When that happens, the soils dry out. You can start to have burrowing mammals like voles coming into the area. The voles like to eat a type of fungi that's in the soil called ectomycorrhizal fungi, and they can disperse that fungi because the spores of the fungi pass through the feces of the voles. So as the voles are becoming active in the drier soil and dispersing these fungi, those fungi are critical to the colonization of the site by spruce and fir. They need those fungi in the soil in order to be able to take up nutrients through their roots. So gradually you get this whole drying of the landscape. What had been a wet valley bottom with a lot of floodplain wetlands becomes more like a grassland, sort of an open grassland with pines and then eventually spruce and fir. So at the site, you lose some of that diversity of habitat and diversity of species that had been present when it was a wet environment. Downstream, of course, you've got things like flood peaks that aren't being attenuated or spread across the valley bottom and slowed down, so they can be more erosive. You may have channels that cut down and widen and become more like arroyos, and you're getting more fine sediment and organic matter and nutrients flushed downstream, which can lead to drinking water quality problems, as I mentioned earlier. There have been some examples of places where there are arroyos. I've seen examples of this in Colorado and Wyoming, and beaver populations are restored, and the channel accumulates enough sediment that it becomes more like a broad, shallow channel rather than a deeply cut arroyo. So obviously, if you take the beaver away, you go in the opposite direction. You're more likely to have a gully or arroyo form.
Now, why have beavers been trapped and removed, and how have their numbers diminished in North America?
Well, initially, they were trapped for commercial purposes. It was mainly for gentlemen's top hats in Europe, and the pressure didn't go off until silk hats were replaced beaver hats. But for a few hundred years, I mean, it started in the 1600s in eastern North America and continued into the mid-1800s in western North America. There was a very high commercial demand for beaver trapping. Beaver furs were used for other things besides just hats, but that was one of the main uses. For our part of the West, say New Mexico, Colorado, I know that the beavers were largely gone by the early 1840s, and that's based on expedition reports such as John Charles Fremont came through Colorado in the early 1840s, and he talks about seeing lots of abandoned beaver dams but almost no active beaver colonies. And that was a pretty fast rate of disappearance because the first trappers didn't arrive here in Colorado until the 18-teens, so a few years after the Lewis and Clark expedition. So within a couple decades, they removed most of the beaver. The beaver did come back once the trapping pressure declined. There are studies in Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado that start in the 1880s, and the beavers were coming back. And the national park was established in, I think it was 1915, something like that. They have regular censuses of beaver populations that continue up to the present. And the beavers were steadily increasing in numbers up to about 1980, and then their population dropped dramatically. And that's something that's specific to Rocky Mountain because of competition with elk. But elsewhere in North America, after the commercial trapping era largely ended, I mean, there's still some commercial trapping, the main losses of beaver populations were associated with either what you could call nuisance trapping. So somebody had a beaver colony established on their creek, and that created overbank flooding that maybe flooded out a road or created damage to structures like irrigation intakes, so they'd remove the beaver. And then there's also just the basic loss of habitat. There are so many places, even small rivers in North America, that have been so altered. Either their riparian forest has been removed and there's nothing for the beaver to eat, or the channel has been channelized and the flow regime has been changed with dams. There are a variety of things that we've done that have made it difficult or impossible for beaver to return to some of their former range in terms of geographic distribution.
So what you've said before gives us some sense of what the land was like when beavers were at their full population numbers. But tell us more about that specifically. I mean, how did they affect the landscapes, and how have those landscapes changed when beavers go away?
I guess the metaphor I'd use in the original title of this talk was the Great Drying, because I think the landscape, whether, again, it was in eastern North America or Arizona and New Mexico or the northwestern U.S., had a lot more wetlands. And we know that based on a variety of historical descriptions, whether it's early paintings or some of the early maps that were surveyed for property boundaries, or journals and descriptions that people kept, and also from sedimentary records from valley bottoms. So they weren't all beaver-generated wetlands, but the primary thing that I would say people of European descent have done in terms of really changing the landscape, other than changing the vegetation communities and removing forest cover, is to lower the water table pretty much everywhere. We have very busily drained and diverted and diked and, in the case of beavers, trapped, and taken out most of the features that created wetlands. So I think if you came to a place like Colorado or New Mexico, or if you travel back in time 200 years ago, one of the obvious things that would be different would be that many of the wide lower gradient sections of the rivers would have a lot more wetlands, ponded water, multiple channels than we're used to seeing today.
So beavers have been trapped, as you say, and they've been removed because they're considered a nuisance, and then they've been reintroduced both to places where they belong and to places where they're not native. What happens when they're introduced to places where they haven't been before?
I presume you're thinking of South America. They were introduced there. Somebody had the idea that they could have a fur trapping business, I guess, or a supply of furs. So they were introduced to the southernmost part of South America, Chile. And it's unfortunately the same story with a lot of other introduced species. The beaver are really altering the environment in ways that are not necessarily helping the native species. Many of the rivers down there are lined by Nothofagus, which is the genus of a southern hemisphere birch. And beaver, of course, cut down a lot of trees. Individual beavers need dozens of trees to survive during the course of a year. So they're really decimating some of the riparian forests along those rivers. I haven't seen too many scientific studies done down there yet, although I actually will be going to Chile within the next year, and I'm hoping to visit some of these sites and have a look at what's going on. The beaver are behaving exactly as they do in North America. It's just that the riparian vegetation hasn't adapted to that type of disturbance that the beaver create by chewing them and cutting them down. So it's altering the rivers down there, but I haven't seen too much about the specifics yet.
So it's the stories of non-native species, it's just a story that you can tell in every country of the world to a greater or lesser extent.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, there are plenty of species that we've introduced that really don't have that big an effect. Ecologists distinguish between invasive and exotic species. Exotic are those that didn't evolve there, that humans introduced, but invasive are the ones that we introduced that then treat it like a smorgasbord and spread everywhere. And not all species that are introduced do that. But it looks like beaver are becoming fairly invasive in parts of South America. And the problem is whenever a species becomes invasive, it's able to outcompete the natives for some reason or other, so it really alters the habitat. And there's an almost endless number of examples in our part of the western U.S., whether it's cheatgrass or tamarisk are two of the probably ones that are most familiar to a lot of people.
That's right. Now, when beavers are reintroduced to places where they do belong and where they have long been native, I mean, I guess when you take them away, there's a great drying. When you bring them back, do then you have a proliferation of wetlands? And what happens?
It's usually not a proliferation. There's a slight increase. There just aren't that many places where beaver have been actively reintroduced. Part of the problem is If you think of the scenario that I talked about with the great drying in a beaver meadow where it goes to what ecologists have called an elk grassland, now you've got this dry, fairly dry meadow with conifers growing. It's not really good habitat for things like aspen and birch and willow and some of the species that beaver prefer to eat. So in order for the beavers to reestablish, you have to have some minimum number of those trees. And the one experiment I know of is on the Medicine Bow National Forest in Wyoming. They reintroduced beaver to a place where they were present historically, but those trees had vanished and the water table had dropped. So for a couple of years, they brought in cut aspen for the beaver to eat, but then they stopped doing that, and the beaver just couldn't survive in that environment. So you can reintroduce beaver if you've done some other things to help them survive. Like in Rocky Mountain National Park, they're putting in a lot of fences in the valley bottoms. They're grazing exclosures to keep the elk out. The elk, of course, are also native, but we removed most of their predators early in the 20th century, and the elk are not dumb. They've figured out that if they go outside the park boundaries, they can be hunted. There's not really an elk problem in the adjacent national forest, but within the park, they've climbed to very high population levels, and they behave similar to domesticated cows in that they like to spend most of their time in the riparian zone along the river grazing. So they actually outcompete the beaver, and they will graze things like willows and aspens to the ground. So in order to reintroduce beaver in that environment, you have to keep the elk out, allow some of the woody species that the beaver eat to regrow, and then they may be able to return to that environment. But I guess I don't know of many examples where beaver have been reintroduced and there's an explosion of wetlands, because usually there's other challenges that limit the size and survival of the beaver population.
And as we've talked about in examples like this, the removal of the wolf has also affected the growing elk populations, because elks are natural prey of wolves. And so, I mean, all of these things affect each other. You take out a top predator carnivore, and that affects everything else.
Yeah, there's a fascinating scenario unfolding in Yellowstone. It was the same as Rocky Mountain National Park. The wolves were removed. Elk numbers went up. They heavily grazed the riparian areas. The beaver dropped off. Since the reintroduction of wolves, the wolves are not only preying on the elk, but they're keeping them moving. So the elk don't spend all their time in the riparian zone, and they're seeing species of riparian trees come back that hadn't been present in several decades, and they're also seeing beavers coming back to those environments. So exactly as you say, by removing or reintroducing the top predator, it has this cascading effect through the whole ecosystem in ways that you might not think about initially, that can end up changing the whole appearance and function of the river corridor, where you go from something that might have been like an elk grassland back to this wet beaver meadow type of environment.
We're talking to Ellen Wool about beavers. She's a geologist at the Warner College of Natural Resources at Colorado State University. Now, are beavers compatible with human use of nearby land, like, say, agriculture and grazing?
Yeah, they certainly can be. Usually it's the humans removing the beaver because they don't like the overbank flooding or the backwater effects. But as you mentioned, beaver definitely seem to survive with humans. It's ironic at Rocky Mountain, there's very few beaver left in the park because of the elk competition, but just outside the park in a residential area in Estes Park, which is outside the national park boundaries, there's a beaver colony that just was established a couple years ago just across the street from a series of houses. And it's the usual conflict playing out for the humans in that neighborhood, because there are some people who are delighted to see these animals and really want to do everything they can to make sure that they're able to stay there. And there are other people who want to get rid of the beaver because the beaver are chewing down an awful lot of aspen that grow along that stream. So instead of having this nice corridor of aspens along their creek, they've got a corridor of stumps in some places and a whole series of beaver dams. So beaver are definitely able to survive and compatible with humans. It's usually that humans don't like something about them and remove the beaver.
Your talk tonight is called Beavers, Architects and Engineers, Our Last Best Hope for Healthy Headwater Streams in the Face of Climate Change. Talk about your hope and vision for the role of beavers and the relationship to climate change.
The mention of climate change has to do with something that ecologists refer to as resiliency, and that's the ability of an ecosystem or a landscape to withstand stress or change. And in this case, the stress or change could be droughts. I don't know what you're having in New Mexico, but we're in a pretty severe drought here in Colorado the last couple of years. And, of course, climate change for the whole Southwest is predicted to be warmer and drier. If you have wet valley bottoms, they're buffers. The more standing water you have and the higher the water table, the better those portions of the river network are able to withstand periods of drought, whether it's a periodic drought like we're having right now or something that may be much more sustained as the climate changes. So allowing beavers to return and doing whatever we can to support them in some of these smaller channels in particular, I think can increase the resiliency of the whole river network and all the other organisms that live in it, and increase the resiliency of our water supply. One of the scenarios I've seen talked about in the scientific literature for mountains in the western U.S. is that as the nature of precipitation changes, as some areas that now get primarily snowfall go to a more rain-dominated precipitation regime, the water runs off the landscape faster. It's harder to manage and store. I know a lot of what we do in the West is store the snowmelt peak in reservoirs and then distribute it to agricultural and municipal communities through the rest of the year. And it's just harder to do that if you have the water coming off either unpredictably or very quickly following rainstorms. So beaver dams, beaver ponds, beaver meadows are all another way of slowing the rate at which water comes off the landscape to collection points, whether those collection points are bigger rivers or our water infrastructure, such as dams and diversions.
So it works better if your watershed is like a sponge than if it's like a plain that water just runs down.
Absolutely.
Now you, as a geologist, have really had to become almost a kind of biologist, or at least work with biologists, because here you are studying beavers and ecosystems as part of your work.
Yeah, I sometimes think of it as environmental geomorphology. I have colleagues who are primarily looking at how rivers respond to the uplift of mountain ranges over millions of years. I have colleagues who are primarily looking at landscapes during the Pleistocene, 2 million to 10,000 years ago. Geomorphology is a very diverse area of geology. It's looking at surface processes and landforms, but there are many of us, like myself, who are more focused on how physical processes interact with plants and animals or with humans to understand more recent landscape change. And I think I kind of view what my research is like as kind of inevitable, because when I was a freshman in college, I literally just about flipped a coin to decide between ecology and geology. And so now I'm a geologist, but I do work with ecologists a lot and incorporate an understanding of ecology into how I look at rivers and landscapes.
You are working as a geologist, you're working as a scientist and studying all of these things. And then you talk to people here in the outside world. What do you think that people, ordinary people, need to understand in order to help really make this world, especially during drought times and during climate change here in the West, a better place for both ourselves to live and for all the animals and creatures and plants that make this ecosystem viable? What do we need to know and understand better?
I think, well, that's a big question. I think I'd start with, I don't know if I can quote exactly, but maybe I'll paraphrase John Muir, who said something like, when we try to pick out any one thing, we find it connected to everything else in the universe. I think being very aware of the interconnectedness that exists in ecosystems, and you know, I've talked about the example from Yellowstone, where I'm sure when people were removing wolves, they didn't think about how that might change rivers, but it did. And reintroducing the wolves definitely changed the rivers. So being aware that whatever particular segment of a river or bit of a landscape you're focused on is connected at a lot of levels to the rest of the world. And I'm not using that world rather than region lightly. As an example, one of the concerns with warming climate right now in the western U.S. is the increase in dust on the snowpack that makes the snowpack melt faster. And some of that dust is coming from the Gobi Desert in China. There's global atmospheric transport of a variety of things, whether it's dust or a variety of contaminants that we create from synthetic chemicals to radionuclides. And those ultimately influence processes in ecosystems in very different locations. So I think the first thing I'd say is thinking about that connectedness at a variety of time and space scales. What if you're looking at a segment of a river, what's going on in the uplands or in the whole watershed upstream from it and influencing that river? And then how have all of those processes changed through time? How does the history of the site influence what's going on today? I think the second thing, and I'm not just, you said the people in the outside world, this goes for scientists too. I think all of us need to approach any kind of restoration or management with a great deal of humility. There are always going to be things that we can't foresee and understand, and we should take a very cautious approach, maybe modeled on physicians are supposed to follow the idea of first do no harm. I think that would be a good thing to keep in mind with ecosystem and river restoration, too. Try and take the lightest approach possible and pay attention to what happens and adjust based on that. I say that because there have been studies showing that a lot of ecological restoration, including river restoration, people have a fixed sum of money and a fixed period of time. They go out and do things, and good, we're done, we move on. But we don't monitor and learn from past mistakes nearly as effectively. So going slowly, adjusting what we're doing as we see whether it works or not, and having that humility and patience, I think would be very useful. So those would be the two things that I would emphasize.
Ellen Wohl is a professor of geology at Warner College of Natural Resources at Colorado State University. She will be giving a lecture tonight at 5:30 titled Beavers, Architects and Engineers, Our Last Best Hope for Healthy Headwater Streams in the Face of Climate Change. It's part of the Amigos Bravos Water Matters Lecture Series, and it's at the Santa Fe Community Foundation. For more information, you can go to amigosbravos.org. Ellen, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Christine Beekman. She's Chief of Cultural Resources and Interpretation at Pecos National Historical Park, and Bill Zunkel, who is President of Friends of Pecos National Historical Park. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Welcome.
Fine, thank you.
Now, this is an interesting time of year because it's Civil War weekend this weekend, March 22nd through 24th. What happens in the park over the weekend?
Well, it's an anniversary event commemorating the 1862 Battle of Glorieta Pass. And this year we have a living history encampment filled with reenactors of period time, 1862, demonstrating not only a day in the life of soldiers during that time, but also demonstrating black powder, which would have been the weapon we used during the time. We also will have kids' tables, and we also have our hiking trail to the Civil War Battle of Glorieta Pass.
So the reenactors get into period costumes, and what do they carry, muskets? I mean,
they do. They do. They love coming out. We are really fortunate to be sitting in northern New Mexico because groups come down from Colorado as well as other places in New Mexico, and they just love showing their period dress, talking about, like I said before, you know, what it was like to be a soldier during that time. We also have a group out of Fort Union National Monument that's New Mexico volunteers.
So what actually happened at the event that they're reenacting?
Well, the Battle of Glorieta Pass was, you know, relatively small. It happened early on in the Civil War, March of 1862, but it was a decisive battle, and it occurred in the area of what we now know as Apache Canyon and Glorieta Pass. And what occurred during the battle is really unique. It's the most north and west battle fought in the Civil War. A lot of people come here and have no idea. Well, I should say a lot of people live here and have no idea that a Civil War skirmish occurred here in northern New Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't a slave state. We're so far west.
Yeah, and you know, again, what's kind of unique is that we had a campaign from Texas, a Confederate campaign coming up the Rio Grande, and their plans were relatively simple: was to travel up the Rio Grande, obtain the supplies at what was then Fort Union, which is currently outside of Watrous, New Mexico, and continue the campaign north and capture the gold and silver mines of Colorado and head further west, win over the sympathies of those Utah Mormons, and eventually capture the ports of California. And the Battle of Glorieta Pass is sometimes referred to as the Gettysburg of the West, because not so much because of numbers, but really the outcome, because the Confederates did not continue any more north or west beyond Glorieta. And it really, really makes you wonder if they were successful here, Fort Union, up in Colorado, if they were successful in Utah, if they would have captured the ports of California, and you know, really how that would have altered greatly the outcome of the war.
Now, are there any artifacts of that battle that still remain in the area?
Well, there. What's really great is that there were mountain howitzers, which are smaller than regular field cannons, that one is actually displayed down in the plaza, the Old Town Plaza down in Albuquerque. And there are some artifacts that we have up at the park. At our visitor center, we have what is called a wrist breaker. It's a saber that a gentleman whose great-grandfather donated it to the park, the gentleman did, who fought in the battle.
So the activities this weekend include not only the black powder demonstration, as you mentioned before, but things like Civil War medicine and drill like a Civil War soldier and small arms in the Civil War, all kinds of things that politics and Artillery Company of New Mexico will be there, and the importance of Fort Craig, Glorieta, and the continuation of Val Verde. You can get a schedule online, and the website is nps.gov, and you can look for the Civil War weekend. But let's talk for a moment with Bill. What is the Friends of the Pecos National Historical Park all about?
What Friends groups do in national parks, most of them all have one, are to give assistance to the park for non-budget items. In other words, the national park system is basically involved in preservation. That's the main thing. They're not involved in retail. They have other things that happen in their area that could be featured. And Friends groups typically help the national parks do that.
So if people want to get involved, how do they do that?
Well, for example, I'll just give you the last project that we did. We have a separate piece of the national park where the battle actually took place. It's called Pigeons Ranch Area. And we combined with the park, the Pecos National Historical Park, we put together two grants, and essentially we built a 2.25-mile trail that gives visitors an opportunity with about 15 different waysides that they can look at information about what happened in this place and that. But it's a very important addition to the park. It allows the visitor to really walk the grounds.
So the Pecos National Historical Park Civil War weekend is this coming weekend, and it's very easy for people to get up there, and also very inexpensive if you want to take, for example, a battlefield tour. For more information, people can make reservations and call 505-757-7241. Bill Zunkel is president of the Friends of Pecos National Historical Park. Christine Beekman is chief of cultural resources and interpretation there. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.